The newspaper man stood up. He was growing restless anyway, and Binet's long disquisition on abstract matters was making him even edgier. "Excuse me, will you? I need to stretch my legs." "Totality's almost here," Binet pointed out. "You may not want to be off by yourself when that happens."
Just a little stroll, and then I'll be back," said Theroman.
Before he had taken five steps, Binet and Sheeran had resumed their argument. Theroman smiled. It was a way of easing the tension, he told himself. Everybody was under tremendous pressure. After all, each tick of the clock was bringing the world closer to full darkness. Closer to the stars? To madness? To the time of the heavenly flames? Theroman shrugged. He had gone through 100 gyrations of mood in the past few hours, but now he felt oddly calm, almost fatalistic. He had always believed that he was the master of his own destiny, that he was able to shape the course of his life. That was how he had succeeded in getting himself into places where other newspaper men hadn't remotely had a chance. But now everything was beyond his control, and he knew it. Come darkness, come stars, come flame, it would all happen without a by your leave from him. No sense consuming himself in jittery anticipation then. Just relax, sit back, wait, watch it all happen. And then, he told himself, then make sure that you survive whatever turmoil follows.
Going up to the dome? A voice asked.
He blinked in the half-darkness. It was the chubby little graduate student astronomer, Faro. Was that his name?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Theroman said, though in truth he had no particular destination in mind.
So am I. Come on, I'll take you there.
A spiral metal staircase wound upward into the high vaulted top story of the huge building. Faro went chugging up the stairs in a thudding short-legged gait, and Theroman loped along behind him. He had been in the observatory dome once before, years ago, when Binet wanted to show him something, but he remembered very little about the place. Faro pulled back a heavy sliding door and they went in.
"Come for a close look at the stars?" Sephera asked.
The tall archaeologist was standing just inside the doorway, watching the astronomers at their work. Theroman reddened. Sephera wasn't what he wanted to run into just now. Too late, he recalled that this was where Binet had said she had gone. Despite the ambiguous smile she had seemed to cast his way at the moment of the eclipse's beginning, he still feared the sting of her scorn for him, her anger over what she saw as his betrayal of the observatory group. But she showed no sign now of hard feelings. Perhaps, now that the world was plunging headlong into the cave of darkness, she felt that anything that had happened before the eclipse was irrelevant, that the coming catastrophe canceled out all errors, all quarrels, all sins.
"Quite a place," Theroman said.
"Isn't it amazing? Not that I really know much of what's going on here. They've got the big solar scope trained on Dovim. It's really a camera more than it is a spyglass, they told me. You can't just squint through it and see the heavens. And then these smaller telescopes are focused deeper out, watching for some sign that the stars are appearing.
Have they spotted them yet?"
"Not so far as anyone's told me," Severa said. Theroman nodded. He looked around. This was the heart of the observatory, the room where the actual scanning of the skies took place. It was the darkest room he had ever been in. Not truly dark, of course. There were bronze sconces arrayed in a double row around the curving wall, but the glow that came from the lamps they held was faint and perfunctory. In the dimness, he saw a great metal tube going upward and disappearing through an open panel in the roof of the building. He was able to glimpse the sky through the panel also. It had a terrifying, dense purple hue now. The diminishing orb of Dovim was still visible, but the little sun seemed to have retreated to an enormous distance.
"How strange it all looks," he murmured. "The sky has a texture I've never seen before. It's thick. It's like some sort of blanket almost. A blanket that will smother us all."
"Frightened?" he asked.
"Of course. Aren't you?"
"Yes and no," Theroman said. "I mean, I'm not trying to sound particularly heroic, believe me, but I'm not nearly as edgy as I was an hour or two ago. Numb more than anything."
"I think I know what you mean.
Athor says there's already been some rioting in the city."
"It's only the beginning," Sephera replied. "Theroman,
I can't get those ashes out of my mind, the ashes of the Hill of Thambo, those big blocks of stone, the foundations of the Cyclopean city, and ashes everywhere at their base,
with older ashes below, down and down and down.
Yes, she said. He realized that she had moved a little closer to him.
He realized also that the animosity she had felt toward him over the past few months seemed to be completely gone. And could it be? She appeared to be responding to some ghost of the attraction that he had once had for her. He knew the symptoms. He was much too experienced a man not to know them. Fine, Theramon thought. The world is coming to an end, and now suddenly Sephira is finally willing to put aside her Ice Queen costume. A weird, gawky figure, immensely tall, came slithering by them in a clumsy, jerky way. He offered them a giggly greeting.
No sign of the stars yet, he said.
It was Emot, the other young graduate student.
Maybe we won't get to see them at all. It'll all turn out to be a fizzle, like the experiment Faro and I rigged up in that dark building.
Plenty of Dovim still visible, Theramon pointed out. We're nowhere near total darkness.
You sound almost eager for it, said Sephira. He turned to her.
I'd like to get the waiting over with.
Hey,
someone yelled.
My computer's down.
The lights, came another voice.
What's happening? Sephira asked.
Power failure, Theramon said, just as Sheeran predicted. The generating station must be in trouble. The first wave of madmen running amok in the city. Indeed, the dim lights in the sconces appeared to be on the verge of going out. First, they grew very much brighter, as if a quick final surge of power had gone rushing through them. Then they dimmed. Then they brightened again, but not as much as a moment before. And then they dropped to just a fraction of their normal light output. Theramon felt Sephira's hand gripping his forearm tightly.
They're out, someone said. And so are the computers. Cut in the backup power, somebody. Hey, backup power. Fast, the solar scope isn't tracking. The camera shutter won't work.
Theramon said, why didn't they prepare for something like this?
But apparently they had. There came a thrumming from somewhere in the depths of the building, and then the screens of the computers scattered around the room winked back to life. The lamps in their sconces did not, though. Evidently they were on another circuit, and the emergency generator in the basement would not restore them to functioning. The observatory was practically in full darkness. Sephira's hand still rested on Theramon's wrist. He debated slipping a comforting arm around her shoulders. Then Aethor's voice could be heard.
All right, give me a hand here. We'll be okay in a minute.
What's he got? Theramon asked.
Aethor's brought out the lights, came the voice of Emot.
Theramon turned to stare. It wasn't easy to see anything in such a low light level, but in another moment his eyes grew somewhat accustomed to it. There were half a dozen foot-long, inch-thick rods cradled in Aethor's arms. He glared over them at the staff members.
Pharaoh! Emot! Come here and help me!
The young men trotted to the observatory director's side and took the rods from him. One by one, Emot held them up, while Pharaoh, in utter silence, scraped a large, clumsy match into spluttering life with the air of one performing the most sacred rite of a religious ritual. As he touched the flame to the upper end of each of the rods, a little blaze hesitated a moment, playing futilely about the tip, until a sudden crackling flare cast Aethor's lined face into yellow highlights. A spontaneous cheer ran through the great room. The rod was tipped by 6 inches of wavering flame.
Fire? Theramon wondered.
In here? Why not use godlights or something?
We discussed it, said Sephira, but godlights are too faint. They're all right for a small bedroom. Just a little cozy presence to get you through the sleeping period, but for a place this size...
And downstairs, are they lighting torches there, too?
I think so. Theramon shook his head.
No wonder the city's going to burn this evening. If even you people are resorting to something as primitive as fire to hold back the darkness...
The light was dim, dimmer even than the most tenuous sunlight. The flames reeled crazily, giving birth to drunken, swaying shadows. The torches smoked devilishly and smelled like a bad day in the kitchen, but they emitted yellow light. There was something joyous about yellow light, Theramon thought, especially after nearly 4 hours of somber, dwindling Dovim. Sephira warmed her hands at the nearest, regardless of the soot that gathered upon them in a fine gray powder, and muttered ecstatically to herself,
Beautiful! Beautiful!
I never realized before what a wonderful color yellow is. But Theremin continued to regard the torches suspiciously. He wrinkled his nose at the rancid odor and said, What are those things made of?
Wood, she replied.
Oh, no, they're not. They aren't burning. The top inch is charred and the flame just keeps shooting up out of nothing.
That's the beauty of it. This is a really efficient artificial light mechanism. We made a few hundred of them, but most went to the sanctuary, of course. You see?
She turned and dusted off her blackened hands. You take the pithy core of coarse water reeds, dry them thoroughly, and soak them in animal grease. Then you set fire to it, and the grease burns little by little. These torches will burn for almost half an hour without stopping. Ingenious, isn't it?
Wonderful, Theremin said dourly. Very modern. Very impressive.
But he couldn't remain in this room any longer. The same restlessness that had led him to come up here now afflicted him again. The reek of the torches was bad enough, but also there was the cold blast of air coming in through the open panel in the dome, a harsh wintry flow, the icy finger of night. He shivered. He wished that he and Sheeran and Binet hadn't finished off that whole bottle of miserable wine so quickly.
I'm going to go back below, he said to Sephira. There's nothing to see here if you aren't an astronomer.
All right, I'll go with you. In the flickering yellow light, he saw a smile appear on her face. Unmistakable this time. Unambiguous.
27. They made their way down the clattering spiral staircase to the lower room. Not much had changed down there. The people on the lower level had lit torches there, too. Binet was busy at three computers at once, processing data from the telescopes upstairs. Other astronomers were doing other things, all of them incomprehensible to Theremin. Sheeran was wandering around by himself, a lost soul. Folliman had carried his chair directly beneath a torch and continued reading, lips moving in the monotonous recital of invocations to the stars. Through Theremin's mind ran phrases of description, bits and pieces of the article he had planned to write for tomorrow's Sorrow City Chronicle. Several times earlier in the evening, the writing machine in his brain had clicked on the same way. A perfectly methodical, perfectly conscientious, and, as he was only too well aware, perfectly meaningless procedure. It was wholly preposterous to imagine that there was going to be an issue of the Chronicle tomorrow. He exchanged glances with Sephira.
The sky, she murmured.
I see it, yes.
It had changed tone again. Now it was darker still, a horrible deep purple red, a monstrous color, as though some enormous wound in the fabric of the heavens were gushing fountains of blood. The air had grown somehow denser. Dusk, like a palpable entity, entered the room, and the dancing circle of yellow light about the torches etched itself into ever sharper distinction against the gathering grayness beyond. The odor of smoke here was just as cloying as it had been upstairs. Theremin found himself bothered even by the little chuckling sounds that the torches made as they burned, and by the soft pad of Sheeran's footsteps as the heavy-set psychologist circled round and round the table in the middle of the room. It was getting harder to see, torches or no. So now it begins, Theremin thought, the time of total darkness and the coming of the stars. For an instant he thought it might be wisest to look for some cozy closet to lock himself into until it was all over. Stay out of the way. Avoid the sight of the stars. Hunker down and wait for things to become normal again. But a moment's contemplation told him what a bad idea that was. A closet, any sort of enclosed place, would be dark too. Instead of being safe, snug harbor, it might become a chamber of terrors far more frightening than the rooms of the observatory. And then, too, if something big was going to happen, something that would reshape the history of the world, Theremin didn't want to be tucked away with his head under his arm while it was going on. That would be cowardly and foolish, and it might be something he would regret all the rest of his life. He had never been the sort of man to hide from danger, if he thought there might be a story in it. Besides, he was just self-confident enough to believe that he would be able to withstand whatever was about to occur. And there was just enough skepticism left in him so that at least a part of him wondered whether anything significant was going to happen at all. He stood still, listening to Sephira's occasional indrawn breaths, the quick little respirations of someone trying to retain composure in a world that was all too swiftly retreating into the shadow. Then came another sound. A new one. A vague, unorganized impression of a sound that might well have gone unnoticed but for the dead silence that prevailed in the room and for Theremin's unnatural focus of attention as the moment of totality grew near. The newspaperman stood tensely listening, holding his breath. After a moment, he carefully moved toward the window and peered out. The silence ripped to fragments at his startled shout, "Sheeran!" There was an uproar in the room. They were all looking at him, pointing, questioning. The psychologist was at his side in a moment. Sephira followed. Even Binet, crouched in front of his computers, swung around to look. Outside, Dovim was a mere smoldering splinter, taking one last desperate look at Kalgash. The eastern horizon in the direction of the city was lost in darkness, and the road from Sorrow City to the observatory was a dull red line. The trees of the wooded tracts that bordered the highway on both sides had lost all individuality and merged into a continuous, shadowy mass. But it was the highway itself that held attention, for along it there surged another, an infinitely menacing, shadowy mass, surging like a strange, shambling beast up the slopes of Observatory Mount.
"Look!" Theremin cried hoarsely. "Someone tell Aethor! The madmen from the city! Fahleman's people! They're coming!"
"How long to totality?" Sheeran asked.
15 minutes, Binet rasped.
"But they'll be here in 5.
"Never mind. Keep everyone working," Sheeran said. His voice was steady, controlled, unexpectedly commanding, as though he had managed to tap into some deep reservoir of inner strength in this climactic moment.
"We'll hold them off. This place is built like a fortress. You, Sephira, go upstairs and let Aethor know what's happening. You, Binet, keep an eye on Fahleman. Knock him down and sit on him if you have to, but don't let him out of your sight. Theremin, come with me."
Sheeran was out the door, and Theremin followed at his heels. The stairs stretched below them in tight circular sweeps around the central shaft, fading into a dank and dreary grayness. The first momentum of their rush had carried them 50 feet down, so that the dim, flickering yellow from the open door of the room behind them had disappeared, and both up above and down, the same dusky shadow crushed in upon them. Sheeran paused, and his pudgy hand clutched at his chest. His eyes bulged, and his voice was a dry cough. His whole body was quivering in fear. Whatever the final source of resolve he had found a moment ago now seemed exhausted.
"I can't breathe. Go down. Yourself. Make sure all doors are closed."
Theremin took a few downward steps. Then he turned.
"Wait. Can you hold out a minute?"
He was panting himself. The air passed in and out of his lungs like so much molasses, and there was a little germ of screeching panic in his mind at the thought of making his way farther below by himself. What if the guards had left the main door open somehow? It wasn't the mob he was afraid of. It was darkness. Theremin realized that he was, after all, afraid of the dark.
"Stay here," he said unnecessarily to Sheeran, who was huddled dismally on the staircase where Theremin had left him. "I'll be back in a second."
He dashed upward, 2 steps at a time, heart pounding, not altogether from the exertion, tumbled into the main room and snatched a torch from its holder. Sephira stared at him, eyes wide with bewilderment.
"Shall I come with you?" she asked.
"Yes, no, no."
He ran out again. The torch was foul-smelling and the smoke smarted his eyes almost blind, but he clutched that torch as if he wanted to kiss it for joy. Its flame streamed backward as he hurtled down the stairs again. Sheeran hadn't budged. He opened his eyes and moaned as Theremin bent over him. The newspaperman shook him roughly.
"All right, get a hold of yourself. We've got light."
He held the torch at tiptoe height, and propping the tottering psychologist by an elbow, made his way downward again, protected now by the sputtering circle of illumination. On the ground floor, everything was black. Theremin felt the horror rising within him again, but the torch sliced a way through the darkness for him.
"The security men," Sheeran said.
Where were they? Had they fled? It looked that way. No, there were a couple of the guards Aethor had posted, jammed up against the corner of the hallway, trembling like jelly. Their eyes were blank, their tongues were lolling. Of the others, there was no sign.
"Here,"
Theremin said brusquely, and passed the torch to Sheeran. "You can hear them outside." And they could. Little scraps of hoarse, wordless shouts. But Sheeran had been right. The observatory was built like a fortress. Erected in the last century,
when the Neo-Gavatian style of architecture was at its ugly height. It had been designed for stability and durability, rather than for beauty. The windows were protected by the grillwork of inch-thick iron bars sunk deep into the concrete sills. The walls were solid masonry that an earthquake couldn't have touched, and the main door was a huge oaken slab reinforced with iron at strategic points. Theremin checked the bolts. They were still in place.
"At least they can't just walk in here the way Follamon did," he said, panting. "But listen to them. They're right outside."
"We have to do something."
"Damned right," Theremin said. "Don't just stand there. Help me drag these display cases up against the doors, and keep that torch out of my eyes. The smoke's killing me."
The cases were full of books, scientific instruments, all sorts of things, a whole museum of astronomy. The gods only knew what the display cases weighed, but some supernal force had taken possession of Theremin in this moment of crisis, and he heaved and pulled them into place, aided more or less by Sheeran, as though they were pillows. The little telescopes and other gadgets within them went tumbling over as he jockeyed the heavy cases into position. There was a sound of breaking glass. "Bine will kill me," Theremin thought. "He worships all that stuff." But this was no moment for being delicate. He slammed one case after another up against the door, and in a few minutes had built a barricade that might, he hoped, serve to hold back the mob if it succeeded in breaking through the gate. Somewhere, dimly far off, he could hear the battering of bare fists against the door. Screams. Yells. It was all like a ghastly dream. The mob had set out from Sorrow City driven by the hunger for salvation. The salvation held forth by the Apostles of Flame, which could be attained now, they had been told, only by the destruction of the observatory. But as the moment of darkness drew near, a maddening fear had all but stripped their minds of the ability to function. There was no time to think of ground cars or of weapons or of leadership or even of organization. They had rushed to the observatory on foot, and they were assaulting it with bare hands. And now that they were there, the last flash of Dovim, the last ruby-red drop of sunlight flickered feebly over a humanity that had nothing left but stark, universal fear. Theremin groaned. "Let's get back upstairs." There was no sign of anyone now in the room where they had been gathered. They had all gone to the topmost floor, into the observatory dome itself. As he came rushing in, Theremin was struck by an eerie calmness that seemed to prevail in there. It was like a tableau. Emot was seated in the little lean-back seat at the control panel of the gigantic solar scope, as if this were just an ordinary evening of astronomical research. The rest were clustered about the smaller telescopes, and Bine was giving instructions in a strained, ragged voice. "Get it straight, all of you. It's vital to snap Dovim just before totality and change the plate. Here, one of you to each camera. We need all the redundancy we can get. You all know about times of exposure." There was a breathless murmur of agreement. Bine passed a hand over his eyes. "Are the torches still burning? Oh, never mind, I see them." He was leaning hard against the back of a chair. "Now remember, don't try to look for fancy shots. When the stars appear, don't waste time trying to get two of them in the scope field at a time. One is enough. And if you feel yourself going, get away from the camera." At the door, Sheeran whispered to Theremin,
"Take me to Waythor. I don't see him."
The newspaperman did not answer immediately. The vague forms of the astronomers wavered and blurred, and the torches overhead had become only yellow splotches. The room was cold as death. Theremin felt Sephira's hand graze his for a moment, only a moment, and then he was unable to see her. "It's dark," he whimpered. Sheeran held out his hands.
"Aethor!"
He stumbled forward.
"Aethor!"
Theremin stepped after him and seized his arm. "Wait, I'll take you." Somehow he made his way across the room. He closed his eyes against the darkness and his mind against the pounding chaos that was rising within it. No one heard them or paid attention to them. Sheeran stumbled against the wall.
"Aethor!"
"Is that you, Sheeran?"
Yes, Aethor."
"What is it, Sheeran?"
Aethor's voice unmistakably.
"I just wanted to tell you, don't worry about the mob. The doors are strong enough to hold them out."
"Yes, of course,"
Aethor muttered. He sounded, Theremin thought, as if he were many miles away. Light years away. Suddenly another figure was among them, moving swiftly. a whirling flail of arms. Theramin thought it might be Imat or even Bine, but then he felt the rough fabric of a cultist's robe and knew that it must be Follyman.
"The stars!"
Follyman cried.
"Here come the stars! Get out of my way!"
"He's trying to get to Bine," Theramin realized, "to destroy the blasphemous cameras." "Watch out!" Theramin called, but Bine still sat huddled in front of the computers that activated the cameras, snapping away as the full darkness swept down. Theramin reached out. He caught hold of Follyman's robe, yank, twisted. Suddenly there were clutching fingers at his throat. He staggered crazily. There was nothing before him but shadows. The very floor beneath his feet lacked substance. A knee drove hard into his gut, and he grunted in a blinding haze of pain and nearly fell. But after the first gasping moment of agony, his strength returned. He seized Follyman by the shoulders, somehow swung him around, hooked his arm around the apostle's throat. At the same time, he heard Bine croak,
"I've got it! At your cameras, everyone!"
Theramin seemed conscious of everything at once. The entire world was streaming through his pounding mind, and everything was in chaos. Everything was screaming with terror. There came the strange awareness that the last thread of sunlight had thinned out and snapped. Simultaneously, he heard one last choking gasp from Follyman, and a heavy bellow of amazement from Bine, and a queer little cry from Shirin, a hysterical giggle that cut off in a rasp. And a sudden silence, a strange, deadly silence from outside. Follyman had gone limp in his loosening grasp. Theramin peered into the apostle's eyes and saw the blankness of them, staring upward, mirroring the feeble yellow of the torches. He saw the bubble of froth upon Follyman's lips and heard the low animal whimper in Follyman's throat. With the slow fascination of fear, he lifted himself on one arm and turned his eyes toward the blood-curdling blackness of the sky. Through it shone the stars. Not the one or two dozen of Binet's pitiful theory. There were thousands of them, blazing with incredible power. One next to another, next to another, next to another. An endless wall of them, forming a dazzling shield of terrifying light that filled the entire heavens. Thousands of mighty suns shone down in a soul-searing splendor that was more frighteningly cold in its awful indifference than the bitter wind that shivered across the cold, horribly bleak world. They hammered at the roots of his being. They beat like flails against his brain. Their icy, monstrous light was like a million great gongs going off at once. "My God," he thought. "My God. My God. My God." But he could not tear his eyes away from the hellish sight of them. He looked up through the opening in the dome, every muscle rigid, frozen, and stared in helpless wonder and horror at that shield of fury that filled the sky. He felt his mind shrinking down to a tiny cold point under that unceasing onslaught. His brain was no bigger than a marble, rattling around in the hollow gourd that was his skull. His lungs would not work. His blood ran backward in his veins. At last, he was able to close his eyes. He knelt for a time, panting, murmuring to himself, fighting to regain control. Then Theramin staggered to his feet, his throat constricting him to breathlessness, all of the muscles of his body writhing in a tensity of terror and sheer fear beyond bearing. Dimly he was aware of Sephira, somewhere near him, but he had to struggle to remember who she was. He had to work at remembering who he was. From below came the sound of a terrible, steady pounding, a frightful hammering against the door, some strange, wild beast with a thousand heads struggling to get in. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered. He was going mad and knew it, and somewhere deep inside a bit of sanity was screaming, struggling to fight off the hopeless flood of black terror. It was very horrible to go mad and know that you were going mad, to know that in a little minute you would be here physically, and yet all the real essence that was you would be dead and drowned in the black madness. For this was the dark and the cold and the doom. The bright walls of the universe were shattered, and their awful black fragments were falling down to crush and squeeze and obliterate him. Someone came crawling toward him on hands and knees and jostled up against him. Theramin moved aside, He put his hands to his tortured throat and limped toward the flames of the torches that filled all his mad vision.
Light!
He screamed. Athor somewhere was crying, whimpering horribly like a terribly frightened child.
The stars! All the stars! We didn't know at all. We didn't know anything. We thought 6 stars is a universe. Is something the stars didn't notice. Is darkness forever and ever and ever, and the walls are breaking in. And we didn't know. We couldn't know. And anything.
Someone clawed at the torch, and it fell and snuffed out. In that instant, the awful splendor of the indifferent stars leaped nearer to them. From below came the sound of screams and shouts and breaking glass. The mob, crazed and uncontrollable, had broken into the observatory. Theramon looked around. By the awful light of the stars, he saw the dumbstruck figures of the scientists lurching about in horror. He made his way into the corridor. A fierce blast of chilly air coming through an open window struck him, and he stood there, letting it hit his face, laughing a little at the arctic intensity of it.
Theramon? A voice called behind him. Theramon?
He went on laughing.
Look,
he said after a time.
Those are the stars. This is the flame.
On the horizon outside the window, in the direction of Sorrow City, a crimson glow began growing, strengthening in brightness that was not the glow of a sun. The long night had come again. 3. Daybreak. 28. The first thing of which Theramon became aware after a long period of being aware of nothing at all was that something huge and yellow was hanging over him in the sky. It was an immense, blazing golden ball. There was no way he could look at it for more than a fraction of a second on account of its brilliance. Searing heat was coming from it in pulsing waves. He huddled in a crouching position, head downward, and crossed his wrists in front of his eyes to protect himself from that great outpouring of heat and light overhead. What, he wondered, kept it up there? Why didn't it simply fall? If it falls, he thought, will it fall on me? Where can I hide? How can I protect myself? For a long moment he hunkered down where he was, hardly daring to think. Then, cautiously, he opened his eyes just a slit. The gigantic blazing thing was still there in the sky. It hadn't moved an inch. It wasn't going to fall on him. He began to shiver despite the heat. The dry, choking smell of smoke came to him. Something was burning not very far away. It was the sky, he thought. The sky was burning. The golden thing is setting fire to the world. No, no, there was another reason for the smoke. He would remember it in a moment. If only he could clear the haze out of his mind. The golden thing hadn't caused the fires. It hadn't even been here when the fires started. It was those other things, those cold, glittering, white things that filled the sky from end to end. They had done it. They had sent the flames. What were they called? The stars. Yes, he thought. The stars. And he began to remember, just a little. And he shivered again, a deep, convulsive quiver. He remembered how it had been when the stars came out, and his brain had turned to a marble, and his lungs refused to pump air, and his soul had screamed in the deepest of horror. But the stars were gone now. That bright, golden thing was in the sky instead. The bright, golden thing? Onos. That was its name. Onos, the sun. The main sun. One of the 6 suns, yes. Theramon smiled. Things were beginning to come back to him now. Onos belonged in the sky. The stars did not. The sun. The kindly sun, good, warm Onos. And Onos had returned. Therefore, all was well with the world, even if some of the world seemed to be on fire. 6 suns? Then where were the other 5? He even remembered their names. Dovim, Trey, Patru, Tano, Sitha, and Onos made 6. He saw Onos all right. It was right up above him. It seemed to fill half the sky. What about the rest? He stood up, a little shakily, still half afraid of the hot golden thing overhead, wondering now if perhaps he stood up too far he would touch it and be burned by it. No, no, that didn't make any sense. Onos was good. Onos was kind. He smiled. Looked around. Any more suns up there? There was one. Very far off. Very small. Not frightening, this one. The way the stars had been. The way this fiery hot globe overhead was. Just a cheerful white dot in the sky. Nothing more. Small enough to put in his pocket almost, if he could only reach it. Trey, he thought. That one is Trey. So its sister Patru ought to be somewhere nearby. Yes. Yes, that's it. Down there in the corner of the sky, just to the left of Trey. Unless that one's Trey and the other one is Patru. Well, he told himself, the names don't matter. Which one is which? Unimportant. Together they are Trey and Patru. And the big one is Onos. And the other three sons must be somewhere else right now because I don't see them. And my name is Theramun. Yes, that's right. I'm Theramun. But there's a number, too. He stood frowning, thinking about it. His family code. That's what it was. A number he had known all his life, but what was it? What was it? 762. Yes, I am Theramun 762. And then another, more complex thought followed smoothly along. I am Theramun 762 of the Sorrow City Chronicle. Somehow that statement made him feel a little better, though it was full of mysteries for him. Sorrow City? The Chronicle? He almost knew what those words meant. Almost. He chanted them to himself. Sorrow, sorrow, sorrow. City, city, city. Chronicle, chronicle, chronicle. Sorrow City Chronicle. Perhaps if I walk a little, he decided. He took a hesitant step. Another. Another. His legs were a little wobbly. Looking around, he realized that he was on a hillside out in the country somewhere. He saw a road, bushes, trees, a lake off to the left. Some of the bushes and trees seemed to have been ripped and broken with branches dangling at odd angles or lying on the ground below them as though giants had come trampling through this countryside recently. Behind him was a huge round-topped building with smoke rising from a hole in its roof. The outside of the building was blackened as if fires had been set all around it, though its stone walls appeared to have withstood the flames well enough. He saw a few people lying scattered on the steps of the building, sprawled like discarded dolls. There were others lying in the bushes, and still others along the path leading down the hill. Some of them were faintly moving. Most were not. He looked the other way. On the horizon, he saw the towers of a great city. A heavy pall of smoke hung over them, and when he squinted, he imagined that he could see tongues of flame coming from the windows of the tallest buildings, although something rational within his mind told him that it was impossible to make out any such detail at so great a distance. That city had to be miles away. Sorrow City, he thought suddenly. Where the Chronicle is published. Where I work. Where I live. And I'm Theramun. Yes, Theramun 762 of the Sorrow City Chronicle. He shook his head slowly from side to side as some wounded animal might have done, trying to clear it of the haze and torpor that infested it. It was maddening not being able to think properly, not being able to move around freely in the storehouse of his own memories. The brilliant light of the stars lay like a wall across his mind, cutting him off from his own memories. But things were beginning to get through. Colored fragments of the past, sharp-edged, shimmering with manic energy, were dancing around and around in his brain. He struggled to make them hold still long enough for him to comprehend them. The image of a room came to him then. His room, heaped with papers, magazines, a couple of computer terminals, a box of unanswered mail. Another room. A bed, the small kitchen that he almost never used. This, he thought, is the apartment of Theramun 762, the well-known columnist for the Sorrow City Chronicle. Theramun himself is not at home at this time, ladies and gentlemen. At the present moment, Theramun is standing outside the ruins of the Sorrow University Observatory, trying to understand the ruins. Sorrow University Observatory. Sephira, he called. Sephira, where are you? No answer. He wondered who Sephira was. Someone he must have known before the ruins were ruined, probably. The name had come bubbling up out of the depths of his troubled mind. He took another few uncertain steps. There was a man lying under a bush a short distance downhill. Theremin went to him. His eyes were closed. He held a burned-out torch in his hand. His robe was torn. Sleeping, or was he dead? Theremin prodded him carefully with his foot. Yes, dead. That was strange, all these dead people lying around. You didn't ordinarily see dead people everywhere like this, did you? And an overturned car over there. It looked dead, too, with its undercarriage turned pathetically toward the sky and curls of smoke rising sluggishly from its interior. Sephara, he called again. Something terrible had happened. That seemed very clear to him, though hardly anything else did. Once again he crouched and pressed his hands against the sides of his head. The random fragments of memory that had been jigging around in there were moving more slowly now, no longer engaged in a frantic dance. They had begun to float about in a stately fashion, like icebergs drifting in the great southern ocean. If he could only get some of those drifting fragments to come together, force them into a pattern that made a little sense. He reviewed what he had already managed to reconstruct. His name, the name of the city, the names of the six sons, the newspaper, his apartment. Last evening, the stars. Sephara, Bine, Shirin, Athor. Names. Abruptly, things began to form connections in his mind. The memory fragments of his immediate past had finally started to reassemble themselves. But at first, nothing yet made real sense, because each little cluster of memories was something independent unto itself, and he was unable to put them into any kind of coherent order. The harder he tried, the more confused everything became again. Once he understood that, he gave up the idea of trying to force anything. Just relax, Theremin told himself. Let it happen naturally. He had, he realized, suffered some great wound of the mind. Although he felt no bruises, no lumps on the back of his head, he knew that he must have been injured in some way. All his memories had been cut into a thousand pieces, as though by a vengeful sword, and the pieces had been stirred and scattered like the pieces of some baffling puzzle. But he seemed to be healing, moment by moment. Moment by moment, the strength of his mind, the strength of the entity that was Theremin 762 of the Sorrow City Chronicle, was reasserting itself, putting him back together. Stay calm. Wait. Let it happen naturally. He drew in his breath, held it, slowly release it. Breathed in again. Hold, release. Breathe, hold, release. Breathe, hold, release. In his mind's eye, he saw the interior of the observatory, remembering now. It was evening. Only the little red sun was in the sky. Dovim, that was its name. That tall woman. She was Sephara. And the fat man was Shirin. And the young, slender, earnest one, he was Bine. And the fierce old man with the patriarchal mane of white hair was the great famous astronomer, the head of the observatory, Athor, yes, Athor. And the eclipse was coming. The darkness. The stars. Oh, yes, yes, it was all flowing together now. The memories returning. The mob outside the observatory, led by fanatics in black robes. The Apostles of Flame, that's what they were called. And one of the fanatics had been inside the observatory. Folliman. His name was Folliman 66. He remembered. The moment of totality. The sudden and complete descent of night. The world entering the cave of darkness. The stars. The madness. The screaming, the mob. Theremin winced at the recollection. The hordes of crazed, frightened people from Sorrow City, breaking down the heavy doors, bursting into the observatory, trampling each other in their rush to destroy the blasphemous scientific instruments and the blasphemous scientists who denied the reality of the gods. Now that the memories came flooding back, he almost wished he had not recaptured them. The shock he had felt at the first moment of seeing the brilliant light of the stars, the pain that had erupted within his skull, the strange, horrific bursts of cold energy racing across his field of vision,